So we are really excited today to welcome Dr. Dana Strauss to our podcast. Dana is a healthcare public policy professional and a doctor of physical therapy. She's a physical therapist by training and brings close to 3 decades of experience at the intersection of clinical care, business of healthcare strategy, and public policy. Dana's here today to share her own perspectives, but in her day job, she leads value-based care and Medicare provider policy for a very large public healthcare organization across their lines of business. She provides expert policy analysis and development related to CMS and innovation, the Innovation Center, especially with the value-based care models, and works closely with multiple trade organizations and associations in addition to the business and their state, federal, and advocacy teams. Dana is very passionate about public policy opportunities to impact specialty care spending and quality, which of course is something very important to us as well here at our team with Proterra and our podcast. As a physical therapist, she's particularly excited about the role PTs can play in supporting value-based MSK care and is very eager to bring that awareness to her fellow colleagues in physical therapy so that they can be part of the solution in helping both fix what ails healthcare at the primary care and specialty care levels. Dana is known for her ability to translate the realities of frontline care and the MSK space into actionable policy insights and opportunities. And whether speaking to healthcare executives, government officials, or clinical audiences, she is recognized for her clarity, conviction, and her unwavering commitment to creating a more ethical, sustainable healthcare system that truly works for patients, providers, and payers across all stakeholders. So, Dana, really excited to welcome you to our podcast. And we've been in touch for several months and kind of around our shared interest on value-based MSK specialty care. And I think there's a handful of us out there that are very passionate about this work. So I would love to hear about your journey as you kind of progress from being a fully clinical physical therapist to now value-based care, working with payers and the government. I'd love to hear about that career arc and how you got into the position that you're in now.
Well, that's awesome. Thank you so much for having me, Eric. It's I listened to your first episode. It was terrific. I can't wait to hear the rest of them and thrilled to be a part of your earlier episodes of your show. So yeah, let me tell you a little bit about my background as a PT. I think it's kind of unique. I hope it inspires other PTs to think about healthcare the way I do to some degree. So I mean, I've been a therapist a long time. I graduated in 1998. Originally with a master's degree, went back after many years to get my transitional doctorate. It wasn't available when I went to school. And I started in an inpatient acute rehab, which was, right, honestly, I still tell all PTs and OTs, if you're not sure what direction you want to go, start there. It's the most physically demanding work with folks who have had some kind of either traumatic event or something really different that's happened to them that changes their life. And I think that starting, and it was at Kessler Institute in New Jersey, I think that really set my career and the trajectory it ended up. So I was there for a couple of years. And what I, from the very beginning as a treating therapist, I was thinking about how each session and each time I spent with patients and families was valuable to them. I know it sounds corny, but I really tried to make every hour that I spent with everyone that I worked with something that they could take away from it, not just be filler time. And when I finally did end up leaving Kessler to move on, I actually moved on to first sports medicine at Kessler and then home health. And I say that because by the time I was 4 years in, I had already done inpatient neuro, inpatient ortho, outpatient neuro ortho, gone on to sports med, opened a clinic for Kessler. And then when I came to home health, I had already recognized that there were patients that were being seen and tons of money being spent on them in inpatient acute rehab that didn't need to be there. And so my very first day in home health, I went to my manager and it was his very first day. And I said to him, so and so, we have to do something about all of these total joint replacement patients going to inpatient acute rehab. This doesn't make any sense. I've looked at the economics of it, and these patients are flying around the gym in a couple of days. And this was all the way back in 2001. So even back then, right, we have more sophisticated surgical techniques, far better than I do. But even back then, they shouldn't have been there. And what I figured out was we could align what was best for our home health agency, what was absolutely best for these patients, which was to come right home. And the home health agency was not benefiting at all from these patients who were being operated on by our own health system, right? So took a while to convince everybody. This was really forward thinking at the time, right? About 10 years before the CJR program. And so we very successfully launched this program. And ironically, right, this was Northern New Jersey. It was the Hospital for Special Surgery that started sending us patients first, because this, you know, again, thinking innovatively, it was ideal. So I think, you know, just I've been a therapist, you know, 20, 27, 28 years. And that was back in year 3, 4. I was already thinking about how can we align what's best for payers. This is absolutely best for CMS, right? Cutting out about $14,000 worth of rehab. Patients were less likely to get an infection back in their own home setting, avoided depression, et cetera. The home health agency was capturing patients that they never saw if when they went to acute rehab, right? They went right to outpatient. And so I think that sort of set me up for a career where I was thinking always about, you know, how can we align incentives and do things better and have it end up better for the patient? Should I stop there, or I can kind of continue to tell you a little bit about?
Yeah, no, I'd love. And then how you kind of took those insights from the beginning and transitioned to actually what you're doing now, both the day job, the side advocacy work, the side innovation work. Would love to hear kind of how those early realizations actually kind of push you forward.
Yeah, well, the timing of this, right? So this was 2001, 2003. By the time 2004 came, I was having my kids. I have two children, and you know, home health was ideal because I could work part time, and I was doing some pediatrics. I was doing a lot of home health for that agency. But when my kids started to get a little bit older in elementary school, then I was really thinking about, okay, what can I do for the rest? What's my career going to look like? Because I knew I couldn't just do patient care. It was it wasn't going to allow me to make a big impact. I coerced I say that lovingly, but I was able to convince the higher ups at the agency that I could do what a nurse could do, and I could be a clinical liaison. And it turned out that I was, you know, I could see things in a way that many times the nurses couldn't. So when it came to transitioning patients from one setting to another, like, how do we make sure they're prepared? How do we make sure they have a successful transition to home health, et cetera? But the timing of this was right at the Affordable Care Act and the first ACO starting in Northern New Jersey. And so this health system that I worked for joined with another very large health system in New Jersey to form one of the first ACOs. And so our system decided to build a pop health department around this. So ACO, and then we had been participating in BPCI and we were not doing so well. So I intervened and started to manage these patients by myself out in the community because I was going to these centers anyway where these patients were going, right? And then, you know, I applied for the advanced program, and then we participated in CJR. I built a whole team around transitions of care, pop health management, and then integrated within the whole pop health department. We did phenomenally, phenomenally well. It was a real team effort between a team of PTs and nurses, both at the hospital and through the post-acute settings. And I partnered very closely with a team of physiatrists and palliative care docs, right, and geriatricians and their physician extenders. And by doing that, we had this kind of multidisciplinary view of patients transitioning from the acute setting with the goal of our pop health department of getting these patients back home safely, prepared, and then staying home and not ending up back at one of the local hospitals. And that really formed a lot of the direction of the last 10 years of my career. Went to a startup, ended up being brought over. I came over to Signify Health, and I came there for the BPCIA program, and then was quickly moved into government affairs because it turned out that there's not a lot of public policy experts in value-based care. And I had turned into one unintentionally.
Now, so you brought up the CJR program a couple of times.
Yeah.
And I know a lot of people know about the program, but can you just, for those who don't, walk through what the CJR program was and why, like, what were some of the main performance metrics and why things like palliative care services actually impacted performance on that?
Yeah, great question to call out. So the Comprehensive Care for Joint Replacement Program, which has now been around for a while, and is a mandatory program that I believe just ended at the end of 2020, or ended last year or the end of 2025. And in that program, right, we are seeing patients who've had either an acute surgical episode or a planned total joint replacement at first it was only in an acute care setting, and then it moved to the outpatient department as well as regulations changed. And the opportunity there is for patients who've had a joint replacement, again, either because of a trauma or more often than not because it's planned. How do we have them have the best experience over the course of that acute time and then 90 days post-op so that they're, you know, getting the right care at the right time in the right setting? I know it sounds really cliche, but as I went back to from 1998, it was the norm that everyone had a total joint replacement and was sent off to acute rehab at the cost of around $17,000 ballpark, and right, not necessarily needing all that care. So by the time we were through, really, you know, several years into it, we had the vast majority, up to 90% of at least the elective total joint replacements coming straight home for home health, and then later straight home to therapy with Medicare Part B, and just going to their physician for follow-up quickly after. As you can imagine, all of this brings down the cost of care. So that's, you know, a large part of the goal. But more importantly, infection rates went down, readmission rates went down, right? Patient experience went up. And so that's the gist of these episodic models. And I spent quite a lot of time in my first 5 or 6 years, 7 years of my work in value-based care, just really thinking about episodes, both for total joint, but also for other MSK episodes and the bundled payment for care improvement advanced program. Yeah. And then lots of medical episodes as well.
If you're enjoying this this podcast and this content around value-based specialty care, please sign up for our mailing list with a link below and stay up to date with all of our educational content, both web-based and in person. And then let's touch on the palliative care, right? So we learned this the hard way doing BPCIA on like hip fractures. But tell me about the palliative care, because people, I would say most people would not assume that palliative care should have anything to do with any sort of program at scale in orthopedics. So love to hear kind of what your experience was on that.
Yeah, for sure. Let's maybe start at this piece about quality, right? One of the quality metrics in BPCIA, I don't believe CJR, but in BPCIA, and many total joint replacements fell into BPCIA, right? Where CJR was not mandated, you could participate in very similar program in that bundled payment for care improvement advanced program. One of the quality metrics was advanced care planning. And, you know, for most orthopedists, I don't want to speak for you or other orthopedists, but in my experience, most of them haven't thought a heck of a lot about advanced care planning or any, you know, their role in that. So, you know, one of the strategies that we would use was to really work with the hospitalist team and work with the, you know, the acute care setting to say, we need to just be asking about goals of care. Many of these folks had come in to your, let's use your example, hip fracture, right? Had an open reduction, internal fixation. Some of them came right from nursing homes. Some of them were living, you know, where they were unsafe because they didn't have enough care, they were fragile, et cetera, and had never had a conversation about what were their goals of care, right? What mattered to them versus what the health system thought they could or should do to treat them. So hip fractures and vertebral fractures and similar ended up being an area of kind of patient diagnoses where we did spend quite a lot of time, you know, working with both the hospital inpatient setting, the hospitalists, the APPs, some of the specialists, you know, making sure the discharge planning team was really aware to flag patients where we were concerned that maybe their goals weren't aligning, you know, learning how to speak about patients' goals of care. And where the palliative care team was so crucial was, you know, the leader of our palliative care department at the time was also a leader within the health system and a really passionate advocate for looking at the full transitions of care and the continuum of care. And so she and her team of APPs came and worked with all of the post-acute providers that were our partners and really started to just introduce this concept to skilled nursing facilities, which, you know, was very brand new and not necessarily always a welcome conversation about whether or not what we're doing and the care that we're providing and the spend that we're incurring is really what aligns with what's best for this patient or what they might, with understanding what the potential trajectory is like for their life and that episode of care, if that's what they would opt into, right? So trying to align what the health system wanted to do in fee for service and what might be best for patients. So they played, that team played a huge role. And frankly, that physician was a really important mentor to me and has to this day, I feel a real commitment to impacting those really complex patients in the seriously ill population.
And you know, so when we look at this, like just like you're describing, someone comes in with a hip fracture. Mm-hmm. We have to, from a clinical side, take care of them well, get them to the, like you said, right treatment, right place at the right time. So maybe they don't need a long-term care facility or acute rehab. They can go home. And we spend a lot of time doing that as well. But then there's the other broad quality measures of advanced care planning and so forth. So we're, after seeing this in play and for hospitals that are doing these kind of bundled payment programs that are from the government side, who should be quarterbacking this care? Now, it's a hospital level initiative, right? So if the hospital, if the outcomes are good, the hospital benefits financially. If the outcomes are poor, the hospital has clawbacks. But who should be kind of quarterbacking this whole process? What division, what department, what agency? Should it be quality from the hospital side? Should it be the orthopedic surgeon? Should it be geriatrics? As those hospitals are doing those bundled payment programs, how have you seen it work best from a coordination perspective?
I mean, I'd say the first number of years was a really tough slog, getting buy-in from, you know, and remember, advanced care planning codes, billable codes were pretty new. They were several years old when we first started this. But, you know, it really ironically, not, or maybe it isn't ironically, but because of fee-for-service, these conversations and even the concept of advanced care planning and it being the role of a physician or an APP were literally foreign 10 years ago. If I would go, you know, up to a physician who was maybe the attending at a skilled nursing facility and say, you know, I think we really need to have a conversation and about advanced care planning and whether or not these goals align, you know, oftentimes he or she would say to me, well, that's not my job, that's a social worker's job. And then, you know, we're into a conversation where that's incorrect, but of course I'm, you know, my role is to be a connector and to be diplomatic. But in order to make progress on advanced care planning, we need the buy-in of physicians and APPs to do it. It's been something that's been up until the advanced care planning codes and probably 5 years later, really just punted to social workers and nurses to have these conversations. So, you know, I think where it needs to happen is really more at that ACO, total cost of care, you know, pop health management level, where I, you know, in an ideal world where providers have accountability for the total longitudinal outcomes of patients, we're having these conversations right when someone begins to have more complex, serious illness, right? When it happens at the hospital, it's never going to be as ideal. It doesn't mean the hospitalists or whoever is, you know, the ideal person assigned. The term that this physician in palliative care used to use, I love and I use it all the time still, she would call it primary specialty care, where we would, there's not enough palliative care docs to go around. So we need PCPs and hospitalists and others to take on the role of being a primary specialist and own this kind of conversation as their role in palliative care. How is what we're doing or what we're thinking about aligned with what's best for you? And really giving them clues about how to have some of these conversations. And then I think, you know, what's interesting is you look at the team model that we're now about to start, the mandatory bundled program that's starting at the hospital. Hospital's going to be accountable for it. One of the things that we see that I really like about this model is there's a responsibility to connect that patient back into primary care. And, you know, one of the things that makes that easier to accomplish is if the hospital already has good, solid relationships with those primary care practices in the community, and then we build off of that. And it starts to be a more organic process where advanced care planning in, you know, truly in the accountable care sense begins at the onset of any serious illness, beginning to talk about goals of care. And then as things change, at any significant change, we have that conversation again to make sure we're communicating well. And I say we, it's not me, I'm not a physician or an APP, but I certainly can tell when it's time for having a next conversation and try to just advise and counsel on that a bit.
Yeah, and advanced care planning, you know, I've got friends and colleagues who, or you know, have founded really great digital health companies focused on advanced care planning because it's so important. And you know, anyone who's had a family member that's gone through kind of a terminal illness knows that Unfortunately, a lot of time these conversations are happening in the hospital at the time of decision making, and that is really tough. But at the same time, it's hard to have those conversations in the office at an annual wellness visit because, you know, a lot will change from the time you have that conversation in a comfortable office setting when you're relatively healthy compared to when something is, much more pressing. And, and I don't know which way it would skew. Maybe more towards a palliative, less towards a palliative. And I have no idea, but it is important, like what you bring up, that those things are done ahead of time. And, I think from a CMS perspective, correct me if I'm wrong, but when we were like really kind of deep in this is that from a quality perspective, it's far better to have a patient pass away in a hospice setting than an acute inpatient setting. Forget the costs, but from a comfort perspective, where you're able to make that patient more comfortable rather than kind of actually undergoing interventions that just simply kind of like that just kind of lose their steam. Am I correct in kind of that interpretation, at least from our experience on why this is an issue from a quality perspective from the government side?
100%. I can give you a really good patient example that it, for whatever reason, this one sticks out. So if you, let's say you have a complex patient who's in a skilled nursing facility and you're kind of working, you know that they're, you know, they have serious illness, they're complex, and that maybe ending up back in the hospital, should there be a reason, might not be what is going to lead to a different or better outcome. And these are they're not the easiest decisions to make to when to have these conversations, especially when you're sitting in a post-acute setting, to enable and empower folks to have these conversations. But this particular person sticks out, and I'm sure you can think of 100 similar examples as a physician who's encountered this. But right, a patient who's sitting with multiple complexities, who's in a skilled nursing facility and does not have a MULST or a PULSED, right, medical orders or physician orders for life-saving treatment, and they decompensate and they don't have a DNH order and they end up back in the hospital. They end up in the ICU for weeks at a time, intubated, and then eventually pass away, intubated in an ICU setting. When the opportunity was there to identify whether or not that's what that person wanted.
Yeah.
And when you look, one of the tactics that I found really successful over the years in a variety of different roles was to show stakeholders along the continuum, here's a patient journey. Let's look at this 6 months of this person's life. Let's take the claims and we're going to marry we have our Pop Health EMR data. And then I would make sure we had always access to all of our post-acute provider signed BAs. We would connect our EMRs and I'd be able to constantly keep track of kind of what was happening. And then, of course, we had embedded clinicians, I'll say, everywhere. And so we'd be able to look at the claims, look at the documentation and say, but what happened to this patient? And was there this episode valuable to anyone other than the person who was directly or the organization directly billing for that care? Right? Was this 70-day episode at the skilled nursing facility where they died 2 weeks later after an ICU stay? Who got the value out of this? Because I can tell you, it doesn't look like it was the patient for it, in this example, right? Or in a similar example, this one is heartbreaking. I've told it before, but I'm assuming many of your listeners have never heard me before, so I'll tell it again. In a skilled nursing facility with a patient who we were transitioning home and had end-stage pancreatic cancer, I couldn't make this determination, but appeared to be actively dying. The husband came to me crying, bawling his eyes out, please help me get her hospice. Now, how many times do you hear families begging for hospice, yeah, right? She it turned out, did have just days to live. I called the attending of the skilled nursing facility, refused to sign the orders. I called the oncologist who told me, no, she's coming back in 2 days to have chemo again. But she might not make it back there in 2 days. And she was still going to physical therapy because they had to skill her to be paid. No one would sign hospice orders. We had to get her out. I was able to convince a nurse practitioner who was a colleague who did favors like this for me occasionally to go to her house, admit her to home care, and then get the physician, her collaborator, to admit her to hospice. She called me screaming at me, how dare they not give her hospice? She was in 20 out of 10 pain, got her on hospice, and she died 12 hours later. Now, how is this system working for anyone except those who are billing in that kind of scenario, right? The oncologist didn't want to give up his billing. The medical director of the SNF was protecting their billing. No one but a lone nurse practitioner doing home visits would stand up for her. I mean, I could cry thinking about it. It was so emotionally torturous. And that happens all the time, right? So, this is what I say, we don't think about necessarily orthopedics and palliative care together. And that particular, the first example was a hip fracture. The second was obviously an oncology patient. But palliative care comes into play for anyone with a complex illness. And it doesn't necessarily mean hospice, but it often does at some point.
So, from that story, you highlighted a story where the husband and the wife, who was unfortunately passed away, realized that they needed to be in hospice. And the kind of pitfalls of our fee-for-service infrastructure, where people don't realize like that end-of-life care is extremely high cost, which means somebody billing for it, right? You've got the medications, the facility fees, the professional fees, all that stuff. What's even crazier to think about is that like a lot of patients don't know like that hospice might be an option, that it might be more comfortable. And I think that, putting myself into the shoes of a rounding oncologist or rounding, maybe not palliative care doctor, but like on a weekend or a Saturday or a Friday night when things are going south, it's very hard to say, okay, as the physician, I'm going to now broach the subject, because the way I'm thinking about it is, look, they're in the hospital now. My job is to give them treatment, and that's what we're trained to do. We're not trained, really, unless we are palliative care specialists, to give those conversations that we don't really always have those skills or that understanding. So for most people, they don't even know that the hospice is an option. And most physicians, they're certainly not incentivized for it, but they may not even know like what the hospice process is, and then they're going to be stuck in the middle trying to navigate it. I will say, though, that we were always taught with these geriatric hip fractures that, the mortality rate could be up to 50% in the year after surgery. And so when I consent patients, I still do, occasional hip fractures here and there. When I consent patients for surgery, I actually even though it was uncomfortable at first, now it's not, I actually bring up that, there's a 50% chance that you will not survive this in a year out. And, we go through risk factors, but it's super important to get that early on. And I think that's probably just something that we as a profession need to get better at. And then, the other thing is that what we learned in these quality programs, especially after surgery, right, there's if you look at hip fractures, there's a proportion of patients that clearly should go home. They're like independent. They broke their hip riding their bike, right? They need to be home. Then there's the patients who are really frail, really elderly, dementia, who came maybe from a facility, they're going back to the facility. It's the ones in the middle that could go either way. And what we found was that the messaging that they got actually when they hit the ER floor from maybe a clerk, from a front desk, from a nurse or from a MA or from a physician, a lot of times there's a culture of, you have a hip fracture, this is what will happen. You get your surgery, then you go to a rehab facility, then you go home. Yeah. And so the messaging, so when we try to fix that messaging, it started from when they enter the door.
That's right.
And so your earlier point where everyone has to be on the same page is so important, because the orthopedic surgeon can say, look, you can go home after surgery, but if everybody's told them they're not going home, they're not going home. And we know the outcomes are better if you can safely go home. But let me ask you a question. When we did this, we found that some people, the reason why people didn't go home more often were fairly like intuitive. Like, hey, I don't have anyone that can take care of me. I don't have anyone that can prepare meals for me. I don't have anyone that can walk me to the bathroom. And we had limitations in kind of being more innovative, because there's all kinds of regulations around, treating some patient groups with some services, other. How do we get around that innovation gap where it would have been easier for us to just hire a sitter or have a meal service come to their house, Uber Eats, but we can't do that when it comes to CMS. And so how do clinicians and hospitals keep innovating when there's so much regulation around what you can and cannot do to do so?
Oh, that's a great question. And I have actually just jotted down 4 points to make sure I touched on. So the first is, in the BPCIA model, you could opt for the hospital to take the risk of the physicians. And when Team was being developed and we were providing comments and we were, providing some technical advice to the Innovation Center as they were developing this model, they had put it on RFI, et cetera. One of the things that I pushed hard on, and I did not get agreement across the accountable care, value-based care policy community. My feeling in my experience for a decade working in these episodes was you have to put the risk on the hospital for the exact reason you just gave, which is if the moment that person enters a hospital, they are scripted and told they're going to be going to an inpatient setting, regardless of knowing anything else about the patient situation, there is very little chance of successfully changing that person's mind. It's like it's imprinted. And it's not just imprinted there. It's imprinted by case management. It's imprinted. I found some of the worst offenders are PTs, unfortunately, my own profession. And part of it is because there is no incentive in fee-for-service to care truly financially about what happens from the moment that person leaves. It doesn't matter to the bottom line of the hospital. So if we want to change something, we have to figure out where the incentives lie and then put new incentives based upon the structure of a new payment model. And so for Team, I felt like, and I'm so happy they did move forward with this. Again, not everyone agrees, but for me, I believe that the hospitals have a chance to do things like changing how we script to patients, how we talk to them from the moment they present at the hospital. Developing really good hospital mobility programs, not the fluff kind, but the kind that are best practice that we've known how they work for two decades. But there again, no incentive in fee for service for a hospital to invest in a fantastic mobility program, although some do anyway. For the most part, it's like pulling teeth. And then to teach and train and coach your inpatient PTs, OTs, case managers, social workers, nurses, all that are interacting with patients to really be careful about the language they use. And because it's best for patients and families to really be thinking about what are the possibilities and what's best. And then unfortunately, it's really having to identify why are we sending patients to certain facilities versus others? It's because they're bringing cookies and taking people to Broadway shows. I've seen it all. And it's very easy to transition someone to a SNF. You hand it over to the person at the SNF and they take over and the case manager's off the hook. And how do we work creatively with home health? How do we work with the best ones who can get in there in 12 to 24 hours? And I'll bring up another thing that I think is just so cool that an organization called Moving Health Home, an organization I've worked with for a number of years, is working on, which is a skilled nursing facility at home waiver, right? And so we have hospital at home. We know it's working because of, COVID and allowing us to create this waiver. Well, it turns out it's working really well. Skilled nursing at home has a ton of potential. If we can beef up what we do in the home health setting, we could get probably 20, 30, 40% more of those patients who, for your exact reason, Eric, they're going home, not because they need daily skilled care in a skilled nursing facility versus some level of intermittent, which could be five times a week. It's because, especially in the first few days, they need more help. And so where can we fund that within regulatory permissions, right? Versus what could a potential waiver allow us to do?
Yep.
And now because of these programs, we have a different incentive to try to create a policy environment that is conducive to something like more care in the home. We know this administration is, Dr. Oz, Abe Sutton, and they've been very vocal the last couple of weeks about wanting to bring more care to the home. So I'm very bullish on it. And I'm happy that the Team model is at least incentivizing the right entity who can then invest for their own financial benefit, not just the good of the patient.
No, that's a perfect segue because we haven't really dove into the Team model yet, right? So the evolution of these programs, right? You had the CJR,
yep.
Then you had BPCIA, and yep. Now CMS Team. Can you walk through in whatever level of detail you think is helpful on maybe some of the because some of the changes are pretty subtle. Some of the changes with the CMS Team model and kind of this whole thing about, from what I understand, like there's certain geographies that are going to be opted in. Do you mind kind of like diving in a little bit on the Team model? And I bet you a lot of people haven't heard about it that should know about it and that work in some of these hospital settings.
Sure. So teen is episode accountability model, transforming episode accountability model. I've been saying team, so, and it's not teams. Yeah. I keep hearing people say teams. No, that's
team.
Microsoft.
Team model. Yeah,
that's right.
It's
not
team.
You. I'm saying I hear.
Yeah.
So
no, no, yeah, I agree. No, because if you ask me what, like, we did, I oversaw our BPCIA initiative, but if you ask me what BPCIA stand for, or the A stand for, I don't even remember. So yes, the CMS team, and it's all capital, T-E-A-M.
Correct. Yeah. So transforming episode accountability model, it is taken from the learnings of the bundled payment for care improvement model and the advanced model. And I'll say the first big difference is that these are 90-day episodes after the acute time where the surgery, in this case, it's going to be surgeries to start off with, and then 90 days after. And I want to call out why that's such a big deal first. Those 90 days kind of put hospitals off the hook. So those who participated, largely their strategy was, okay, we're going to leave the mothership alone. The hospital doesn't have to do anything. We just want to get them to participate. So they're going to take on the risk, or maybe we'll, you know, have their hospitalist take on the risk. But really what we're going to do is work on using better skilled nursing facilities, trying to reduce their length of stay, and then try to have some impact on their readmission rate, especially after the first 30 days when it's less, you know, it's less of an impact to the hospital at that 45-day readmission, right? But what there's a lot that we learned and a lot was accomplished in this model. But when it comes to hospital transformation, there was some programs that absolutely did a lot of hospital transformation. But some of them punted it and said, well, we could just get enough savings by reducing skilled nursing length of stay and reducing discharge to SNF, and that's going to be the program. And so, you know, what we found was after day 45, a very large majority of the patients that were readmitted were admitted for a completely different reason. These are just complex patients. The mortality rate actually was something like 25, between 20 and 25%, depending on what types of episodes were chosen. So the second big difference was this is a mandatory model. And that's so important because what we found and what the Innovation Center's very aware of is there was attrition just based on it got too difficult. We're just going to pull out of it. We've made our X millions of dollars. We're done. We're not going to participate anymore. And unfortunately, that really limits the ability for the model to continue to transform care, particularly because those who continued to participate were investing in care transformation. And it was dropping off all of those who decided it wasn't necessarily part of their strategy and investing there was not necessary. So it was easy to say goodbye to it, right? So in the transforming episode accountability model, it's mandatory in certain CBSAs. So that's like a geographic area. And it is about 742 hospitals total. And it's for five surgical episode category types. But that's just to start. If you look at the language used in last year's proposed and final rules, the language CMS used was, well, we're going to start here because it's where we found these episode categories led to the earliest financial success and quality improvement success. And then as long as this is successful, the plan is to continue to add to these episodes over time. What I think is going to be interesting to watch for, one of the things is, it wouldn't be surprising to see the Trump administration eliminate the inpatient only list again, as they did the first round, right? President Biden's administration brought it back again. It would be logical, we don't know, it's reading tea leaves, which is one of my favorite hobbies, that the inpatient only list could go away. And in that case, we're going to have more episodes turn as the surgical procedural episodes become outpatient episodes, which will add another interesting layer to this as we remove more and more of the post-acute, that post-acute, you know, outside the hospital opportunity. So what we're looking at now is only 30 days post-op. Once a patient ends up in a SNF, you've lost money on them in this shorter episode. Yep. So the goal, right, is to get people moving, and don't let them end up in skilled nursing because you have failed to mobilize them in the name of safety, right? We know falls are, and technology can help tremendously. I'm listening to podcasts about how they're using AI to determine who is going to fall, and looking at them real time is just incredible. But keeping patients moving and getting them home, that's really going to be what moves the needle. And it's truly what one of the very few levers that CMS has to help transform care in acute care hospitals. One of two, the other is global budgets, which is probably outside this conversation, but another time. So episodes of care, crucially important. Do they necessarily tackle specialty care? I think we could argue that point both ways. For this, I think really it's about hospital transformation, and certainly there's ways to provide more standardization across things like anesthesia and potentially surgical procedures, but that's beyond where I'm going to opine.
So, and you're correct, we could kind of go off on the deep end on this, especially with all the changes coming with the new administration. And some of these things have pretty wide-ranging bipartisan support, which is uncommon. Like the whole thing with prior auth and bring down utilization management, like that's a pretty universally supported idea. The inpatient only list is, they've got some double-edged sword to that. But, if you look at total joint replacement, right? I mean, only a fraction are inpatient Medicare fee-for-service. Most of them are outpatient. And so obviously it's pretty straightforward. Some of these procedures, like a complex a spinal surgery, tumor surgery, all this stuff, it's going to be in a hospital setting. And the docs are pretty good at understanding where they go, because when I do surgery, like there are certain surgeries I will not do in an ambulatory setting because they're more complicated, they're more involved, they need to be in a hospital. I'm not saying inpatient versus outpatient. It actually gets very confusing. There's inpatient, outpatient, 24-hour stay. And we as surgeons are supposed to figure out how to code these cases ahead of time. It's actually very confusing what all this insurance company regulation has done. But one question I have for you is, when you meet with physical therapists like that are focused on clinical care, what is the compelling reason for them to actually care about what's going on the policy side or the value-based care side? Like, why should they care if you're a private practice, solo practice owner? If you're part of a big hospital system, fine, I get that. But like a community physical therapist, maybe a solo owner, should they care, or what will it take for them to need to care about this stuff?
Mm-hmm. I'd say the first barrier is awareness. In my experience, PTs, unfortunately, have lived in their silos. And I'm not sure whether some of that is because they achieved like direct access, meaning they, for those who don't know, right, you don't need, I think it's in all 50 states now, you don't need a prescription by a physician or an APP in order to start PT. You can go. It depends whether the payer is going to pay. In Medicare, you still need to have the order signed by a physician. But I think some of it's that kind of fierce independence they've clung on to in fighting for this access that kind of is in line with their doctoral education. I want to hop to the hospital side for a second. A hospital and inpatient PTs and OTs, unfortunately, what I've seen there is kind of just a dropping of their own professional autonomy, meaning what I've related it to, I think, is as we moved to Medicare in the early 2000, 2001, when we went to PPS and payments became that one bundled payment for the hospital stay in a DRG, right? Or if you're in home health, an HHRG, or the Oasis in home health, I said, or what's the MDS and SNF. Therapists don't own the billing. They're not seeing any difference between care that they provide and their own reimbursement or the reimbursement of their organization. We're a cost center essentially everywhere else. So in the outpatient setting, there's more of a chance to have real productive conversations about things like, here's how you can be a part of benefiting from these changes. Like if you look at what is going to be their incentive to care, it's in last year's proposed and final rule, CMS called out in the team model that hospitals should contract with outpatient PTs. I don't, unless I've told them, I don't know a single PT that has seen this on their own or figured it out. They're not used to looking at regulations, like basic, payment regulations. It's just not part of the therapy culture. I will say, once I bring this to certain entrepreneurial therapists, they run with it. There is so much value that they could potentially add, especially in a short episode like TEAM, where many patients can come right home and go right to outpatient PT in the home. A nurse is not always necessary, and that home health episode is going to include the nurse and increases total episodic spend, right? So as long as I can get a therapist in the outside to see this, I feel like I'm, again, aligning the policy opportunity in a model like TEAM with what's best for patients, which is get them home and moving as quickly as you can, as long as they're safe. And safe can often just mean excellent training of the family so that they're prepared when they go home. Many people are willing to hire help for a week or two so that they get back on their feet, because that means they can come home, right? We make assumptions about what people will and won't pay for without asking and engaging them in what this looks like altogether, right? Yeah. So that's been somewhat successful. I think remains to be seen where we end up seeing those contracts develop. And the inpatient side, totally different. I've struggled over the years with speaking to countless rehab departments on the inpatient side who write on just about everybody, unsafe, discharge to SNF, unsafe, discharge to SNF. Where are we basing this on? That is not how we are being helpful to the patients that are part of our care that we're consulting on, or to the health system at writ large, frankly. So.
Yeah, when we did the BPCIA, like, the big issue was those patients on the margin that could go home or SNF after hip fracture. And a lot of credit to the team at Henry Ford, because we did a drastic turnaround in getting people home safely. They should have been home, but it took about 3 years, and it took that whole kind of understanding of the communication change. The other thing is that it took quantitative metrics to understand who could qualify for home. So there's a red light, they go to SNF.
That's right.
Green light, they go home. The yellow light, there's a grading system and a point score. And it's based on all kinds of different objective and subjective data. But then you have a score that says, okay, if you're within 10 to 15 points on the scale, you could go home. And then you at least have something to base off of. This goes back to the talk to us about the part you talk about, the AI part, right? You can actually quantify risk, not even with AI, but certainly it helps with AI. And so it's just super fascinating, especially as you think about this, where we dove into kind of care planning, discharge planning, post-acute, all on the topic of MSK specialty care from the setting.
Mm-hmm.
One question I like to ask as we kind of wrap up is, given your journey and your career progress from being purely clinical to now kind of on the cutting edge of policy and innovation and value-based specialty care, what are you most proud about in your career today? And what are you most excited about kind of as you look ahead?
I would say, to pin it down to one thing, I'm proud of, globally, my ability to bring the clinical on the ground perspective to policy conversations. It's no one's fault, but they're sorely lacking. Those of us who bridge between full clinical care and move into something else, a lot of times that's like client success, sales, there's lots of different ways clinicians go. What I love about this, the bridge into policy, which frankly was completely unintentional, I went with where I felt driven and most interested, and where I kept finding ways to make a difference, right? It turns out that the policy space for a clinician who's been on the ground is such an incredible place to make an impact. Health policy drives everything else that happens in healthcare to one degree or another. And when we can shed light for policymakers, either on the Hill or with our regulators, when we can shed light on the impact of policy on patient care and on outcomes and on spending, whatever it is, the combination that they care about, we can start to see changes that really do have lasting impacts. But that gap between what theoretically sounds like it makes sense, or they've heard a lot about from lobbyists within certain, parts of the healthcare ecosystem, start to become Bible. And they don't necessarily all get to hear the truth of how policy impacts patient care and clinical care. And I've always liked to bring that really objective, right, objective view of what a patient journey looks like and how policy changes and policy opportunities can change the result of a patient journey and a patient's even multiple year journey towards their end of life. So I guess that's what I'm most proud of, bringing my clinical perspective and my experience in managing populations to the policy conversation at the coalition level within my, you know, organization, and then in working with policymakers.
So, and what's the most what excites you most about the road ahead, especially as it comes to this, these new things in policy on value-based specialty care?
Oh, I'm so glad you asked that final question. I'm really stoked about MSK care right now. There's a couple of things that I'm watching. I'm hearing a whole lot of noise around episode groupers. And I'm sure, you know, for some, especially the orthopedists listening to this, who are in your ecosystem are familiar with that term, but you know, there's two sets of episode groupers that we always historically heard about, the PACES model and the Prometheus model. And there are organizations using both hospital and health system organizations and then private equity organizations using these episode groupers to try to attribute spend to certain providers very specifically. And there are new groupers in development. And these groupers are turning out to be one objective way, it looks like, in the kind of the early noise that I'm seeing, one objective way to possibly impact specialty spend. When, as you know, it can be hard to engage, especially surgical specialists in value-based care, because it's hard to find the right incentives. So when we look at the opportunity in irrefutable data and an AI's ability to call out and highlight that data and kind of what that looks like in terms of an episodic spend, I think we're going to see, and maybe I hope to see, and I'm projecting some of that, that we can more specifically and maybe subtly impact the quality and reduce the variability of spend. And I think about MSK a lot here, particularly as a PT, where I feel like for a whole host of reasons that are no one's fault really, except for the fee-for-service system, therapists tremendous value in avoiding preventable and unnecessary higher cost care has not even begun to scratch the surface, right? Our ability to treat them and see them when they first present to primary care, our ability to, right, even bring awareness to therapists so that they can have an impact if they understand how their work can impact longitudinal spend and outcomes. So that's what I'm really excited about. I'm going to watch this noise more and more play out and see where we see the innovation center land. I suspect they're going, again, reading the tea leaves and listening to what they're saying publicly, I won't be surprised to see something around MSK spend, because out of the cup, there's a handful of chronic conditions that contribute to a tremendous amount of cost. And where there's high cost, high variability, there's opportunity. So I'll leave it there.
No, this has been super exciting. I love this because we're getting all those different specialties in and really understanding what specialty care is from a value-based side. So Dana, I thank you so much for joining us and for your engagement. And I'm sure there'll be a lot of follow-up engagement as well. People may be reaching out to us to kind of get deeper in, and maybe a follow-up podcast as well as these progress. So yeah. Thank you so much, Dana, and I really appreciate you joining us and your expertise.